He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan.
Joining us is the... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say we're joined by... Who are we joined by, Jim?
Well, we are joined, as we are every Monday, Marjorie, to discuss the moral dilemmas of the day. Reverend Irene Monroe. Hello, Reverend Monroe.
Hi there.
And Reverend Emmett Price. Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Good to see you both.
Hey, thanks for having us back.
And glad to be here. And you know, it was wonderful to have a weekend without a blizzard.
That's well, true. Well, there was snow
just
still.
A couple of inches. Okay. So President Obama got all weepy as Aretha Franklin gave a surprise performance for Attorney General Eric Holder's farewell on Friday. I think we have a little sound of Aretha. Do we not? Do we? Oh, we don't. Okay, I thought we did.
So
oops.
How do you guys...
is it... Beautiful. Oh, spacious sky.
Wow.
That woman has a career.
Yeah,
I'll tell you, she can really
make
something of herself.
How old is Aretha Franklin now? She's going to be about 68.
About 68.
Yeah, she hasn't lost her voice. Good for her.
So essentially, she closes the thing. The president wept. I don't know if you mentioned that, Marjorie. My apologies if you did. Aretha Franklin and the president did a fist bump thing, which I sort of think is pretty cool. How do you rate, what's the legacy of Eric Holder, Emmett Price?
Well, I think Eric Holder is probably one of the great attorney generals we've had. Clearly first African-American. Third longest serving. The fact that he was from the original cabinet of President Obama, I think, is significant. He's had some hiccups and some bumps, but I think his trends on gay marriage, I think his trends on protecting voting rights, I think his trends on civil rights of all of our citizens within the country has been extremely significant. I think he was trained. I mean, he worked with Janet Reno in the Clinton administration, and I think he brings a certain integrity to the office. Again,
and compassion.
He
was the people's attorney general. He wasn't at arm's length. He was quite reachable, and it's not just around Ferguson, but just the way in which he had dealt with issues in general. So, really, a stellar legacy. Now, I know, Jim,
I'm too embarrassed
here,
to
that
say
you
what
don't
I'm
like
say.
Him.
I
know
no, no,
stand
no, no,
him.
No, 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 no. I know that is
nothing
first of all,
but criticize
let me
him.
Speak for myself here. First of all, on race issues, he's as good as anybody gets.
The best we've
ever
had.
And a lot of people would like the president to have been as forthcoming on these issues, but a lot of people think Holder was the designated person to speak for the president. Prosecutions in the media for leaks and things at a greater level than I think any time in American history. Little weak on Wall Street. But the thing that really put me over the edge, because I do think he deserves huge praise on the civil rights front, this defense of your high school classmates'
I knew you
access
were going there.
To the president of the United States. Eric Holder tries to explain, I don't know how much he twisted himself into a pretzel to do this, that it's okay that a tax dodger who has never been prosecuted, unlike mere mortals, who owns millions of dollars of liens, hundreds of thousands of dollars in back taxes, that of course would be Reverend Al Sharpton of MSNBC, Holder explains why he has access, like other people, to the most important person in the world. Now, I know he has to do that because he has to defend his boss, the president. Is that not troubling to you at all, Irene Monroe?
Well, of course it's troubling, and I think it's troubling to any tax-paying American citizen. But while clearly there's we see a mismanagement of Al's personal and business, expenses. There are two things that are operating here, one of which is that there is an ideology among a small group of African Americans who feel that they should not have to pay taxes.
So why doesn't he say that?
Well, it would be nice. And I mean, part of it comes out of the whole idea that our labor has been exploited, slavery and post-slavery. And in some ways, it is an aggressive move towards reparations. That's one. But the other thing is this here. Al is...
I wish everybody could see the smile on Irene's face as she's explaining this to me.
Yeah. Al is Obama's, go-to guy for the African African-American community. It's important to understand what was playing at the time to give Al this kind of leverage, political leverage.
What was it? I'm dying
here. Well, there was this sort of war between Cornel West and Tavis Smiley versus Al Sharpton. When Obama came on the scene here, Tavis Smiley and Cornel West were the most influential voices to and for the African-American community. Every February, Tavis would have his State of a Union address. One particular year, the first year that Obama was running, he had invited Obama to come. Obama decided not to come. He felt rebuffed, and he said, I will bring Michelle. So with that came a tsunami of attacks by Cornell as well as Tavis Smiley, to the point that the African-American community distanced themselves from Cornell and
so
Tavis.
Sharpton rode to the rescue?
Absolutely.
How about you, Emmett Price? How does this strike you?
Yeah, I'm bothered by it. I think Reverend Sharpton needs to pass in his hall pass and give it to somebody else so they can have access. I think he represents an older generation, generation that I think President Obama already has in his back pocket. I think he needs to invite younger leaders who have the pulse on what the younger generations are looking towards and looking for, and allow that access to happen. I mean, because it's always this old school entrenchment of people from the previous generation who get, you know, carte blanche.
And always from the African American church in many ways that now stands, and I know I'm going to get a tsunami of criticism, but it's a relic. It holds us back in many, many ways.
But by the way, Marjorie.
Hold on for a second. We had somebody in here last week, and I forget who it was, who was talking about Al Sharpton in Ferguson.
I can't remember.
It was a reporter from the Globe.
The Washington Post.
I'm sorry. He used to be at the Globe. Now he's at the Washington Post. He was in here. He covered Ferguson when all the uprising and upset was happening. And he did say, which I could see, having seen him speak in person in Cambridge and once in Boston too, that Reverend Al, that I'm no fan of either, came in and sort of diffused the situation by bringing everybody to this big church that they could fit like 1,500 people in or 2,000 people in. And it could have been a volatile scene on the street, but instead of getting everybody inside the church. And he credited him for doing that. And I saw him speak over in Cambridge. He was like an hour and a half late. I was ready to shoot myself. I had to write a story and I was on deadline. But boy, when he came in, I mean, the guy is a talented, you know, he's got that black preacher thing down. He's a very talented guy. So I'm not a fan. I don't think he's...
Well, it still doesn't excuse... I mean, if all that's true, and I was impressed by what Lowry said to us, too, about his impact in Ferguson, I think this reflects most negatively on the President of the United States, not on Al Sharpton. Obviously, if you're a tax evader and you get access to the most powerful person in the world, of course you do it.
It's a hiccup.
But I understand your historical analysis.
The thing is that at the time, I mean, in many ways, Obama owes Al because Al brought this huge voting block. And he rewarded Al with MSNBC.
So who are they going to vote for? John McCain? I'm serious. I don't mean that to disparage McCain. I mean, African-Americans were going to vote for the first likely black president, were they not? Okay, fine. Let's move on.
Let's move on.
My favorite story
of the week. And this is not to compare any people to things, but this kind of reminds me of people call cars their vehicles instead of their cars. This is this weird story, which I get now that I've read it, that if you ask white people what you think of blacks as opposed to African Americans, they're going to like African Americans a lot more than blacks, which I find kind of crazy. So I guess that means no one should use the word black anymore.
Well, it's not just like. It is likely that the African American, according to white respondents, is more educated.
Yep.
The African American earns more. And by definition, the black person earns less. And you know what this is analogous to me? Not what Marjorie said, but for me, I'm sure I've said this before, my favorite video on American politics in the last few years was when Jimmy Kimmel sent his reporter out to Hollywood Boulevard to ask people if they preferred the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And of course, everybody preferred the Affordable Care Act, and they hated Obamacare, not realizing they were the same thing. What do you make of the survey, Emmett Price?
Yeah, I think it's ludicrous. I'm not sure that I want to judge what I call myself based on how white people feel about it. But I thank God I have an Irish name, right? So Emmett George Price III.
But where do you think it comes from, though? What's the genesis?
He's a black Irish,
don't you know that?
He will be in the St. Patrick's Day
That's
parade.
That's not what I meant.
Okay. Homage to his enslavers, but go ahead.
Well, Deval Patrick can march with you, another Irish guy.
Locked armed.
Go ahead.
You know, I think part of the black nationalistic moment in the 60s and 70s I think people associate that with more of a less passive and more aggressive movement for civil and human rights. And I think that association in terms of that angst that was there,
But Emmett, though, I feel that you're missing some of what I would call the biblical and historical antecedents. We come out of a culture long before our black nationalist movement where black has always been deemed negative. And so what happens is that it doesn't change over time as much as that.
Black in any context?
Black in most contexts. Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a classic.
Black hat and white hat.
Wait, but let me give you something that is recent, okay?
Black
that sheep. Is a real, and this well-known comedian couple did a spoof on it, Black Ice. Well, the truth is that the ice is really not black. It's invisible. It's invisible ice. And what, interestingly enough, is that, I don't know if you're familiar with Key and Peele, but the interesting thing about it is that, you know, again, we use black in such a negative way that it's very, very hard to get away from that, like blackball, or better yet, blackmail. If I say blackmail, you know, am I talking about Emmett, or am I talking about a fraudulent behavior, or have we collapsed to assume that if we're talking about a blackmail that this person is criminal? So, I mean, this is how we collude when we racialize language and we're too lazy to think outside of the box.
So should we stop using the term blackmail? Should we say African-American all the time?
Maybe? I don't like the term African-American.
What? Really?
Well,
how
yeah,
come?
Because I think, you know, if you're Irish-American or you're Japanese-American or Korean-American, you're not called by a continent.
Right.
Right? And so
yeah.
Africa's not a country. It's a continent. And for many of us, we don't know where our ancestry is and what particular country within the continent. And so for me, race is a human construct anyway. We codify people based on their ethnicity and nationality, not necessarily based on the racial origin, right? Because it's a human race.
I disagree with that. I think, you know,
Of course you would.
okay, see, you know, you see how he gets my dander up? Okay.
No, I'm right. with him on this okay. one. Go ahead, Irene.
You know, I should just be silent, but I can't.
By the way, that should
imagine,
be a soundbite on the show. Of course you would.
If Emmett and Irene were married, Emmett says Placid Sugar and Irene gives him a big speech
but
about
just,
what's wrong
just,
with sugar.
Just imagine what the makeup sex would be like.
Let's not imagine. Okay, fine. Go ahead, Irene.
Okay.
What was your point?
Well, my point is that I like the term African American in a way that it ties you to where your roots are. The point is this: I don't like the term Hispanic. I'm not Hispanic, but I do like when people say, you know, I'm Puerto Rican American, I'm Dominican American. I think that that's important because I'm part of this history, the making of this country. And I think that when you black is a political term, and African American
is a cultural term.
Yeah, but it's also a political term because you will find Southeast Asians or other people who feel oppressed use the term black. So I like both, but clearly when you have a name like Shanika Jenkins, and I hope God or Shanika isn't listening, I don't even know who this person, or Laquanda Jones, it automatically points a negative kind of connotation for not only white folks, but certain African-American blacks.
It's a cultural term that deals with the African diaspora, which goes from the continent of Africa through the Caribbean, West Indies, South and Central America. So if we're going to do the whole kind of, you know, pedagogy, you know,
the etymology of it,
the etymology of where
trajectory,
we're going, you know, those of us who have Caribbean blood, those
but
of us who
do.
Have indigenous blood
African
in it,
Caribbean.
It's black is all encompassing.
Well, yeah, we lost the original point, which was that when whites were surveyed, and by the way, this is not a minor disparity. It's a huge disparity.
Absolutely.
In terms of how they perceive blacks and how they perceive African Americans. And so what you both explained the history. You explained why you had a problem with Emmett. But what does it say about 21st century America that there is that disparity?
That we have to get off of the white perception as being the baseline, right? So I understand the point of the survey is to sense what is more appealing or more palatable, and I think that whole idea is ludicrous.
Okay, but that's not enough. This is what I think. One of the problems that we need to problematize in this is that I always call it the conspiratorial trap of whiteness. When you buy into this white identity, you lose your history because What I'm asking you is, when did you become white? When did the Irish become white? When did the Jews become white? When did the Italians become white? And so I think, if anything, that when I hear people say I'm white, I feel like they don't know their history. And I think that if we say we're black, in many ways, we deny a particular kind of history, too. So I like the term African-American, African-Euro. We have African-Germans. So I think
it's also an important labeling. When you talk about Caribbean blacks and Haitian blacks, is Haiti in the Caribbean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Very much so.
You know, or
Cape Verdean
blacks. I remember growing up, New Bedford was full of Cape Verdean blacks. They were Portuguese.
That's right.
It became a big issue in the Civil Rights Movement. Were you Cape Verdean or were you black? And there's a whole schism between African American blacks. Well, I don't know, schism is too strong a word, but between, Caribbean blacks, too, there's
you'll even find some Haitian Americans who say, look, I'm not African American. They're very distinctive because they don't want their history and their culture just blended in.
Yeah.
That they want it. If we're saying we're not a monolithic group, let's hold up that we come from all parts of the world, whether we migrated there or we were brought here on a slave boat. So I very much embrace the term African American, and I was very, very glad as we look at the trajectory where we were called, Negro, colored, Afro-American, to finally settle at African-American. And it's an expansive term because Obama's configuration of African-American is very different than the African-Americans we know coming from a history of slavery.
Can we change gears? We spoke about Eric Holder a couple of minutes ago, and apparently the Justice Department is about to say there's a pattern of racism in the behavior of the Ferguson police, even though apparently they're going to say that there was not racist motivation
on the part of this Ferguson thing was?
Yeah.
That they were the cops there were disproportionately ticketing and arresting African Americans and relying on the fines to balance the city's budget.
Well, by the way, that's not that out. I mean, the fact that it's racially motivated, according to Justice Department, is one thing, but cities and towns do that all over the place.
I know, but pick it on black people or African American people to balance the budget was a little
outrageous. I'm less interested in that story now because of a story that was handed to us as you two walked into the studio. Tamir Rice was a little 12-year-old boy who was killed by the police, a little black boy in Cleveland, was killed by the police. He was holding a toy gun. The original story from the police was that, this, by the way, is written by Wesley Lowery, we were just talking about from the Washington Post, who was with us last week. The police said that their version of the story was that they either told him to put it down or spent a handful of seconds before they shot. And when you see the video, as soon as they stopped the car, they shot this kid and killed this kid. They're essentially in the litigation that the family has filed. The city is essentially saying that it was the kid's fault, that it is not the police officer's fault. The city's defense, and what I was unaware of until I'm reading the story when you guys came in here, I'd forgotten. The mayor of Cleveland is black.
Black.
Is African American. Yeah, yeah. Whatever
yeah,
he is.
Yeah, whatever, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are we supposed to say? Black?
Well, it depends on who we're talking to, Irene or Emmett.
Right.
But
it's African American for me and black for him.
This is obviously a hyperbolic statement. This is almost as bad as the shooting. Yeah. Is basically to blame the little boy who's playing with a toy gun, who obviously had no animus directed at anybody, just playing. This is the kind of thing that really poisons discussions for long periods of time, Emmett Price, no?
I mean, this is ludicrous. I mean, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, right, and expecting, I mean, the challenge is this. At what point can kids be kids anymore?
That's right.
The young man is 12 years old, was 12 years old. And here you have the person from the Patrolmen's Association talking about he was a menacing 5'7", 191 pounds. The quote is, he's a 12-year-old in an adult body. I mean, how do you even get to the level of that kind of heinous thinking that a 12-year-old kid who was playing on a playground
by himself, by the way, the head
of the cop union said this last week. It isn't like he said it in the passion of the after the shooting.
And these same cops that are saying this now lied about what happened.
Absolutely.
Remember, they were saying it was a group of kids tucking the toy gun into his waistband. Right. Then they had the video, which showed nothing of the sort was going on.
And also the way they treated his sister, because his sister ran out and said, you shot my 12-year-old brother.
Yes.
And then they treated her like a criminal as well.
Yeah, threw in the patrol car.
But one of the things I'm glad that you brought up here is that, the mayor of Cleveland husband is African American. And one of the things that we got to look at when we look at it so narrowly, just in terms of just white cops, is that we really got to change the culture of policing. Because just recently, I was watching this morning on the news where in L.A., these cops tasered and then killed this homeless guy. And it was a mixture of them. It's trending in the news now. And so the point is that, well, again, you have a culture here that it really doesn't matter if the cop is black or white. It's a kind of training and mindset about how we apprehend perceived criminals or how we apprehend folks that we feel threatened by.
Well, the other question is what this is a tired old subject, but what is the conversation? The president appointed a commission who's looking at those body cameras. We discussed this with Boston Police Chief Evans last week, talking about the militarization of police. Will anything come of this, or will in a year or two will we just have another cycle of violence like this that gets people up in arms? Understandably,
but this is a question I want to know: where's a safe space for black bodies to live in America? This reminds me when I was reading A Warmth of Other Suns, and the doctor in the story was driving, trying to find out where in America could he drive, step out, and not have to deal with race. And so my question is where can we live? And one of the things I always worry about, and I'm not being rhetorical or hyperbolic, I always wonder when I leave this studio, will I see Emmett again?
Well, by the way, Emmett is you were a victim. You told us a couple of months ago. Eric Holder was a victim of a driving while black or walking while black kind of incident. It's just unbelievable.
So I think that you know, one of the things that Commissioner Evans is doing great here, and he says it every Wednesday when he's on, that in terms of the training for the young cadets as they go through their systematic training, he brings people from different communities to engage with them and to have discussions and to share a viewpoint of what the perspectives are from this, you know, from the various ethnic and communities.
Yeah.
And so I think that's probably a practice that needs to happen across the nation, in Cleveland, in Ferguson, and all across the board.
You know, one of the disappointing things, I hope I get this right, and one of the three of you will correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that Mayor Walsh urged the president to have Commissioner Evans part of that team of people, and it was rejected.
Yes.
And I have to say, again, I don't know many police chiefs. I am so with you. His approach, preemptive approach to trying to deal with diversity, communities of color, poor kids, at least from my lay perspective, is exactly what a top cop should be doing.
I have a question for you, too. Yeah. Are race relationships worse than when now or
you mean under after six years of Barack Obama?
Well, not about Obama, but when you were growing up, are they worse now?
Much better, I think.
Or much better?
Well, I think because I mean, I shouldn't say there's less segregation because some places, I mean, Boston is pretty segregated, but I just think that I know many more black people than I did when I was growing up as a kid. And I think my children have had a much different childhood with much more integration in the schools than I ever did as a kid. So I don't know. I think they're better, but I could be being Pollyanna about that.
Or a Polly Marjorie. Now, here is the...
answer the question. What do you think?
I think the answer is they're better, but it ebbs and flows. I think one of the problems... We've had this discussion before. One of the setbacks, I think, is I never thought I'd live long enough to see a black president. But the flip side is, how many people in 2009 and 2010 said, essentially, racism is over, or virtually over, because we have a black president?
Well, because we're running out of time. Do you guys think it's better or you think it's worse?
I think it's a changing same, as Leroy Jones or Mary Baraka used to
say. The more things change, the more they remain the same. So that's how I see it.
Okay, so it's Pope Watch time.
I was too much of a Pollyanna.
What's the issue here, Marjorie?
The issue is Pope Francis once again has been railing against the global economic order, calling money the devil's dung.
And his czar is a pimp.
Well, actually, his finance czar actually may be.
With his bling-bling theology and also the bling-bling he wears on his robes.
Okay, so I guess you didn't get
he
any
spent
points
a half million
today.
Dollars probably more than he should have. So let's start with Emmett so we have an upbeat and then we'll end on a... So the Pope is essentially railing against throwaway culture, as Marjorie described. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think the Pope has a focus in places that we call, whether right or wrong, third world countries. And to see that the way that the economic disadvantage and disparity is in those places, there is a sense that we need to do better in terms of being responsible and accountable with currency and with money. But I think we can all do better.
Okay.
I always say don't throw stones if you live in a glass house. And so I think that if this would be very wonderful if he had a robust embrace of liberation theology, because that the edict of that is a preferential option for the poor. So you're looking at changing the paradigm that have kept people.
I thought he was a liberation theologist.
No, he doesn't. He's not at all. Okay. He doesn't embrace it. He's like his ex.
Okay.
And I don't mean love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us something else we didn't know about here. I mean, Monroe. Not, okay.
I qualified. I did my best.
That
you
piece
did.
Will be in Bay Windows by Reverend Irene Monroe.
I'm as down low about it. What I know is possible.
Okay. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. You never know what she's going to say. You can see her at the Huffington Post, or reader,
great,
I should say, and
both.
Bay Windows. Reverend Emmett Price is a long-suffering professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and the Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thank you very much for coming in. Up next, we're asking you if it makes sense to base bus and train fares on how much money you make. They're trying it in Seattle. Should they try it here in the Bay State? You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.